Welcome, beloved listeners, to some of the very best of L&L on RN Summer.
Not everyone can have what you want. Fame is a crowded room. Everybody wants the one shot at the sunspot that's up at the top. I'm the one who can jump to the front of the line, make the sun shine. Do you know who I am? Ooh. Follow me and you'll hit the spot. I can sell everything you've got. Make you into what you are not. Package and mold you, lick you and fold you. Get your head around this, I am offering bliss. Blow me a kiss, do you know who I am? Do you know who I am? Do you want to feel the heat? People screaming at your feet. Hold yourself steady. Yeah, you're already mine.
Do you know who I am? Do you know who she is? No, it's not Lottie Lenyer or Marianne Faithfull. I'll tell you who she is in just a minute. But first of all, I should say that this is LNL. And welcome, Gladys and Potties, to what I hope will be a particularly fascinating program. You've just heard a grab from a film called Goddess, in which my favourite Australian comic, Magda Szubanski, plays a lethal advertising executive called Cassandra Wolfe. And I'm going, Magda, I had no idea that you could sing. I know you can do. I know you can do everything bloody well else, but sing?
Oh, I wouldn't say that. But I think sometimes having a bit of an ear for accents and musical ability they go a bit hand in hand. But yeah, I was relieved that I didn't disgrace myself. And it's fun. It's really fun to sing. But, you know, it's in a studio in a controlled environment. It's always a nice way to do it.
I wonder whether you remember a moment in your long career when we were both in a restaurant at the Siebel, which was the sort of the showbiz hangout in Sydney.
I do.
And I professed undying love to you. Do you remember that?
I reckon I might have professed it back. Yeah, I do. I do, because it was such a haunt, the Siebel. That was where all the show folk used to go. And I can't remember who you were having lunch with. You were engaged in a lengthy, chit-chatty, boozy lunch with someone. And I remember I came over and joined you for a bit, but for the life of me, I can't remember who the other person was.
What I can remember is we're talking 30 years ago.
I mean, yeah, it would be a long time ago, yeah.
Okay, let me now remind the listener, the Gladys and the Potties, just what you've been up to since then. You've got a long list of Logies and Astra Awards and People Choice Awards as long as your arm, not only for comedy writing and performance, but as one of the best loved figures in this wide brown land. And Magda began her time in comedy back at Melbourne Uni when she was spotted by an ABC producer, hallowed be his or her name, and soon she was jumping out of the TV screens in 3D in, the D-Gen generation, which I thought was wonderful. Went on, of course, to fast forward Big Girl's Blouse, and with Gina Riley and Jane Turner, and of course as Sharon Strzelecki on Kath and Kim. Well, look, so many credits, films like Babe, The Golden Compass, Handy Feet, and the aforementioned Goddess, theatre roles, Guys and Dolls, Grease, etc. So Magda, it is just heaven to have you on the Little Wireless program. But if you don't mind, I want to start off with being a bit sombre before we get on to the funny stuff. Many, many years ago, a great Polish filmmaker, Andrew Wajda, in fact, it was 1956, made a film called Canal. It was how the Polish underground used the sewers under the city to move around and to try and survive. You've been down those sewers. Why?
Because my father had been down one of those sewers. In fact, my father told me to watch Wajda's film Canal. After the Warsaw my father was in Poland during the war, my whole family, obviously, the name Szubański being Polish. And he fought in the resistance, as did many other Poles. And the city, the, you know, 200,000 people were killed and the city was flattened, and the only way for the resistance members to escape was through those canals. And I vividly remember my father describing to me what it was like in those canals. And the Vida film that depicts it as hell on earth is not a metaphor that if hell exists, I think, you know, one of the places it exists is in those canals. And I remember my father saying how they were escaping, the Germans were above them, and I was in all ignorance. I was saying, well, you know, couldn't you have had a flashlight or a light or something? He said, don't be ridiculous. You know, the Germans would open a manhole and drop a carbide bomb and you'd be gone. And they couldn't talk. It was in utter silence. And he said, you would be walking for, you know, it was like 8 or 10 hours or something to get out, you know, while the Germans are destroying your city and your country above you, walking out through shit up to your chin for about 8 or 10 hours. And he said, and every now and then, it was the only time he'd really been scared. And my father did some pretty extraordinary things during the war, but this was the only time he was really scared. And he said, you would be walking along and suddenly your foot would go just down through something. And I said, what was that? And he said, the body of someone who hadn't made it. And he lost the grip. They would walk with holding onto the belt of the person in front of them. And he lost the grip of the man in front of him. And in that pitch black, he said, he just really went into a total funk. And so when I did Who Do You Think You Are, they took me back to that very sewer that my father had been in, which was sort of quite a chilling moment. Even now, you know, if you have even a hint of claustrophobia, it's pretty full on. But to think of that, you know, and those kids that used to guide them through, they were scouts, girls and boy scouts, and they would guide them through. And one of them was telling me he would sit there for 5 hours in the pitch black. And it's unimaginable courage. So, yeah, so that's the story of the sewer.
I understand that when your father tried to tell people about his experiences after the war, people found them hard to believe.
Yeah, I think that's kind of true of a lot of Polish experience. If you've ever read any Tadeusz Konwicki, he has a fantastic description of that kind of... I think it's probably what the experience that a lot of people who've experienced deep, ongoing trauma and horror feel, that when they try and tell people about it, it's so alien to our experience. And certainly when Dad, I think even in Britain after the war, I mean, the Brits were going through their own thing, but I think what the Poles had gone through was just such a, you know...
It kept getting worse because father fights in the Warsaw Uprising against the Nazis while the Soviets stand by and watch 200,000 men, women and children die.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, they kind of orchestrated it, really, you know. And the Polish fight for freedom, it's almost like a joke when you speak to any Polish person. I went to Poland last year and met with Raymond, my father's cousin, who's more like an uncle to me, you know. And I was with my friend Stella and we were asking him, you know, about Poland. He said, well, in 1795, with the third partition of Poland, you know, it all that sort of destruction of Poland and the way that it vanished from the map, and their ongoing fight for independence, I think, and their struggle for democracy wedged between two imperialist powers is something that's very interesting for all of us. But the other reason that people found my father's story improbable is because he was an assassin in an execution squad, a top secret counterintelligence squad. And if you had met him, you would never have thought that. He was 5'4", he was cheery, you know, he played tennis and mowed the lawn, and he was not like a 007 James Bond.
But he was under instructions from the Polish government in exile, wasn't he?
They had this
hit or that one.
Yeah, they were. It was mandated by the government, and the Poles took a very hard line on collaboration because, of course, there are a lot of... ethnic Germans who were in Poland who were called Volksdeutsch, and they were operating sort of as a fifth column within Poland, and so they were, informing to the Nazis where the names of Polish resistance fighters, but also they were telling the Gestapo where Jews were hiding, and my family were hiding Jews.
Which was, of course, a death penalty.
Poland, not many people know this, but Poland was actually the only country where the penalty for hiding a Jew was the death sentence. So the level of risk I mean, I look at, you know, honestly, I look at pictures of my grandmother, and whenever I meet any people who knew that, they go, oh, you look so like your babcha, you're so like your babcha, you know. She was a fat, middle-aged, upper-middle-class woman who was, you know, slept every night with a gun in her pocket and the Polish flag folded up underneath her head, and they held resistance meetings at their house and they hid Jewish people, and my grandfather and my uncle were smuggling guns into the ghetto. And I just think, you know, the level of courage is kind of mind-boggling, really.
And it's on both sides of the family, in a sense, because your mother's side of the story is...
We're trounced, because, yeah, Polish and Irish, the two, can I say, shat upon?
Absolutely.
I think there
and
are a lot
used
of...
used to be, of course, the victim of the worst racist jokes.
Yeah, the dumb Pollock jokes and the Irish jokes, all of that, yeah. My Irish grandfather was a different sort of a character. He was... My father and his family were very altruistic and very... idealistic in a lot of ways and very patriotic and all of that sort of thing, whereas my Irish grandfather was just... But my Polish family, you know, were quite well off. So, you know, comparatively with him, I mean, before the war, they had a really great life. They were off to the ballet every month and the circus and skiing in Zakopane, and, you know, they had a really good life. But my grandfather, my Irish grandfather, just came from generations of absolute unrelenting poverty. And it was very interesting when I did the Who Do You Think You Are program to go and learn much more and to realise just how Irish I am. And now when I reread The Dubliners, I go, oh, my God, that's that's so my family. You know, a lot of it makes sense.
But your ethnicities are remarkably complex. There's very few people I know who are as multifaceted, as Rubik cubed as you are.
We got a bit going on because my dad was Polish and it's just pretty much Polish all the way along there. But on mum's side, she's the mongrel. Her father was Irish. She's Scottish. My mum's Scottish. Her father was Irish. Her great-grandfather, my great-great-grandfather, was an Italian sculptor who, believe it or not, and this didn't make it to air, but there'd always been this family legend about, remember the grave robbers, Burke and Hare?
Absolutely.
Yeah, who were notorious serial killers. They killed like 16 or 17 people in order to make a tidy profit. And sold the cadavers to Edinburgh University. Well, my great-great-grandfather, Luigi Izzeponi, who was from Lake Como, was a sculptor in Edinburgh of some renown. And at a very youthful age of about 18 or 19, he did the death mask for William Burke.
Wow.
I know. So when I went to the Department of Anatomy, which spookily enough my father had studied at after the war because he studied medicine, they took me there and there's this head of William Burke, a death mask that my great-great-grandfather had worked on. So we're kind of like just death, 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 death until we get to Australia, my family. It's pretty darn grim. So,
and then you jump out of the great cake of humour and keep us all laughing. I want to get onto that later because it's very often, in my experience, comics, good comics, great comics, do have a lot to cope with in their personal, psychological or family lives. It's often a form of exorcism.
Oh, yeah, exorcism and denial and joy and life-affirming. It's, you know, it's interesting that we're talking about this. It's something that I'm sort of interrogating in some work I'm doing at the moment, like what is comedy for and what is it about and where does it come from? And, you know, I certainly think for me, when you look at Sharon Strzelecki, I think part of what people love about her is there's also a bit of a melancholy in her. You know, there's a vulnerability about her.
But that's something that's true of all your characters. There's always a poignancy about them. And you are life-affirming as a comic. You know, there's a lot of warmth in your interpretations of people. Even no matter how bizarre, how odd, how nutty they are, you can feel your fondness for them.
Oh, good. Oh, good, because I actually, you know, I do love people. I'm a people person, although I can be quite hermity at times. But, I love that. One of the things I do love about performing is that you know the expression walk a mile in my shoes. Well, you kind of do that. You're literally wearing the character's shoes. You're, for some time, a period of time, you're experiencing what it's like to be you know, clothes maketh the man. And when you wear that costume, you go, oh, my God, that's what it would be like to be that person. And it tends to make you a little less judgmental, I think. So,
Whenever I'm asked about who are the cleverest people I know, and, you know, for doing this job, you get to meet a lot of awfully clever people, I always talk about comics. You know, whether it's the genius of Barry Humphries, not always a kind comedian, often quite lethal and vindictive.
Oh, yeah, but hilarious. Yeah. Cruel, but funny.
But a total genius. Or, yeah, of course, our mutual friend John Clarke, you know, who's all kindness, all giving.
Yeah, gorgeous man, yeah.
This is Eleanor on RN Summer, and my guest was comedian, actress and singer Magda Szubanski. Okay, let's sort of move around a bit. You came out a little while ago. Was that difficult or easy?
By the time I did it, it was a lot easier. Although it was still, it's a hell of a, you're just kind of making yourself very public, I think, and it's something I had thought about for a very long time and hesitated over for a lot of reasons, not least of all because I'm actually quite shy, as a lot of performers also are. But I think as I've gotten older, I've felt more comfortable moving out from behind the characters and being my real self, and felt more of a desire to do that. But, you know, after years of therapy, I think I felt in a really good place to do it. But even so, I did have a what-have-I-done moment afterwards, which was just pretty much, it's like buyer's remorse, you know, when you buy a house or make some major commitment and you go, oh, my God, what have I done? So I took myself off to Spain because my friend Diego had somewhat erroneously led me to believe that Spain was like a gay paradise and the streets would be paved with lesbians.
I don't remember that being the case.
No, curse him. But it was fascinating, actually, to be there. I wanted to sort of be in a place, I just needed to be out of Australia for a little bit, but be in a place where they had gay marriage and total equal rights. And that was a really interesting experience because a lot of the people that I met there, I interviewed some politicians and academics and actors and there was no sense of having to bargain. You know, like there was no sense of what gay people bring to the economy or anything like that. It was purely just, all of them just spoke on a rights basis, and it very much came from their oppression under Franco.
Isn't it interesting that very often hardline Catholic countries that have had dictators like Salazar in Portugal or Franco in Spain are the first to jump completely in the opposite direction?
Yeah, oh, the Catholic Church is so complicated. It's always been two sort of different churches, really. There's the magisterium, or the, you know, career priests, as I like to call them, and then there's the real church, you know, and that real church is so concerned with social justice, and it's a natural extension of that. I mean, you know, the Catholic Church, you know, I mean, I am so absolutely culturally Catholic, all the elements. The one thing that is glued all of those mongrel elements of my family together has been Catholicism. You know, they've all been Catholic. And it drives me a little bit crazy that something that is very profoundly my heritage I'm excluded from because of a decision that's been made by the magisterium. But, you know, I think the bulk of people who are in the church actually, you know, are in one way or another going against edicts there, you know.
But you don't have to be in the church. As my producers know, I've got a very strong view that the best guests tend to be lapsed Catholics. They bring with them, you know, the sense of social justice, the wonderful sort of Catholic, all the world overview, and a liberation from dogma. The number of great people who are lapsed Catholics, LCs as opposed to RCs, is astonishing.
Well, I found myself strangely, it's something I'd always written off for a while, and then I, for some reason, I don't know whether it's just something I'm having to re-examine, because before I came out, one of the things I did do was start reading the Bible and some interpretations of the Bible, because I thought that would be where most of the criticism came from. Luckily, you know, there wasn't a lot of criticism anyway, but it was like I had to pull the Bible out of my own head anyway, because it had gotten in there and really messed with me, that whole Catholic upbringing. But I think maybe, you know, I just, for whatever reason, I have a very, quite a religious spiritual temperament, and there is something.
But haven't you moved towards Buddhism?
Oh yeah, look, I'm a little bit up for wherever will have me. to an extent.
In a sense, another aspect of the mongrel, a word you use, which I love, incidentally.
Yeah, love a mongrel, but good old mongrel. But no, there's a lot of things, I think, going from my father's experience, and it has left me always with a sense, which is very typically second generation. And the Poles are in a funny situation because, you know, if you say you're a second generation Holocaust survivor, if you're Jewish, people immediately know what that means. But, you know, my closest friends, Polish friends, both of them, their grandparents were in concentration camps, and my family were hiding Jewish people. My father lost his best friend. You know, they were deeply, deeply affected by what was happening to Jewish people as well as to themselves. But how you reconcile all of that with pacifism, and how the Buddhists deal with that same kind of invasion in Tibet, and then turn that around to think of compassion for their oppressor, is something that really, really interests me.
But as you know, if you go back far enough, there are very close connections between Buddhism and Christianity.
Yeah, well, you know, some people, I don't know, but some people say that in those missing years, Christ went off to India and learned a bit of Buddhism there. But
And is buried there. You can visit his tomb.
Have you been?
A good Catholic girl. No. Catholic girl couldn't possibly do that. It's blasphemy. Anyway, let's circle around to mongrels.
Yeah.
Known in the beef business as hybrid vigour. I remember once I had to do the I was running the National Australian Day Council on Australia Day, and I did an Australian Day address, and I got myself into terrible trouble by praising the notion of a mongrel nation. I see it as our great strength, whereas others, of course, see it as dangerous. You know, the current attacks on multiculturalism are escalating and getting nastier.
Mm.
But there's something wonderful about a society which has got as many ingredients as ours. It's like a mosaic with lots of brilliant tiles that make a picture.
Well, you know, exactly, yeah, that is what they speak about, hybrid vigour, and it certainly, you know, means that you have to think more quickly and be more fluid in your thinking and more open in your thinking, and that you're trying to reconcile. Or you learn to reconcile. I mean, you look at Obama. He's a great example of someone who's able to build bridges between people because he's not just any one thing. And I think, again, the Polish experience really informs my attitude towards multiculturalism, because that's something where you've sort of seen over the course of, you know, maybe 1,000 years or something, or, you know, probably more like 600 years or so, the destruction of tolerance, you know, because Poland, you know, in the 14th, 15th century invited the Jews in and was a very multicultural, multi-ethnic, multi-religious country. And then over the course of various invasions has ended up being, you know, up until 1795, before the country was taken over by the Austrians, the Prussians and the Russians, Poland had no laws against homosexuality. It was the only country in Europe that had no laws against homosexuality. And it was only when it was overtaken by Prussia, Russia and Austria that homosexuality was outlawed. And then again, when they gained their independence in the 1930s, they decriminalised it. So for me, you know, that's a very alive issue, how cultures managed to work together. Because you look at what happened to Poland in the end, and now it's a terribly homophobic, you know, by and large, country. It's very mono-religious. And, you know, there are elements of anti-Semitism that are really disturbing. And
all of that is true. All of that is true. And I, on my many visits to Poland, a country for which I have a profound love, you're conflicted by this bombardment of contradictions. But you're also confronted by what I still regard as the most moving post-war gesture anywhere, and that is the rebuilding of the old city, when the people were living in rubble, eating rats, and they clean up the rubble and the bricks and they start to rebuild the old town.
Yeah.
What an achievement that was. What a piece of collective spirituality.
Beautiful. And it also says something about history too, that, you know, that then becomes, then the destruction of that town becomes kind of like a blip. You know, in a few hundred years, that town will be, that old part of the town will be very old again. And it will be seen over the course of its, you know, however many hundreds of years of that one moment of destruction. But
Do you remember the story, Magda, that there was the paintings of Canaletto and his son that were used as blueprints for the rebuilding? Another bit of hybrid vigour.
Yeah. But just to go back on the stuff that you were saying, I mean, I was recently asked to be, partly, you know, because I am such a mongrel, the MC at a conference about multiculturalism. And one of the things that really interested me to learn was that 47% of Australians are either foreign-born or have one parent who is foreign-born, and that really, multiculturalism here compared to the guy who was talking about it was saying we shouldn't draw lessons from Europe because they don't actually practice multiculturalism. They practice monoculturalism. And what gave me great hope was that here, by and large, it does work, and it's not by accident. It's because of social engineering. So it's been approached a lot more cleverly here. And that was very exciting.
Social engineering. I remember that beginning with the term New Australian, which was a clever bit of button pushing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But they sort of had policies in place to, rather than just letting it happen, to try and ensure that it would work. So it's a complex thing, but, you know, I mean, there is, as I say, there's more than just the bells and whistles of food and music. There's being informed by different ways of looking at things so that, you know, if you start to become really entrenched in something. Yeah, it's like travelling, isn't it? Except that, that those different viewpoints are coming here instead of us having to go elsewhere to find them.
You're often called on to MC events. I understand that you're doing this with the Dalai Lama during his Melbourne visit.
I am, yes. I'm very honoured. That's a very great honour. He's an amazing human being. I think he's such an important person to have in the world. I mean, you look at what the Catholic Church is doing at the moment and you think, you know, dudes, your only job is compassion.
We should have snuck him into the Sistine.
Yeah, I mean...
He'd make a bloody good pope, actually.
Wouldn't he? Wouldn't he? You know, I think a lot of people who, you know, that fantastic phrase from Karen Armstrong where she says there's a God-shaped hole in the world and he kind of fills it, I think, for a lot of people, actually.
Well, even for a dyed-in-the-wool, lifelong atheist like me, he has my respect. Say your name, your whole Polish name for me, because it gives me goosebumps.
In Polish, yeah, my name please. Would be Magdalena Maria Teresa Szubańska.
Isn't that sexy? I reckon that's terrific.
It's better than Magna Zabanski.
Yeah. Well, coming back to sexuality, because that's multicultural as well, isn't it? I was born into a world where you divided the sexes into A and B, like it was only Catholics and proddies. It was a very simple thing growing up in East Kew. But sexuality, which I think, if there is a God, it's his greatest joke, sexuality is so complex, so multifaceted.
Yeah, and I think that was one of the big things for me in terms of coming out because, and it has sort of been a bit lost in the wash, although I was careful to say, you know, I'm gay, 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 a little bit not gay, 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 because for me it was, what word am I going to use to describe myself? I don't want to misrepresent, but that is the truth of my experience, and I'm a, you know, in terms of relationships with men, I'm a never say never, I'm not 100%er. And so I had to also partly wait for a time when the world had got a grip of the idea of sexual fluidity and was more comfortable with that so that I could be coming out and just and absolutely honestly without any sort of defensiveness or feeling like I was, you know, pandering to one side or the other, but just really representing for the vast, you know, the lot of us who are somewhere in the middle, you know.
Did you get a backlash? Did you get hate mail and nasties? Or were people accepting?
No, it was absolutely beautiful. A couple of crazies on Twitter who I find sort of hilarious. It was
overwhelming. You find them hilarious?
I do. Because they're just so out there. And I sometimes go and sort of look into their little Twitter file thing and look at the tweets they've done to other people and it's just a mad barrage of abuse. Yeah. And I just sort of go, oh, okay, well, won't be taking that very personally, then you're just crazy. But no, it was overwhelmingly positive, actually. It was really lovely. It was very, very moving. And And I wasn't sure how it was going to go, you know, because it's a sort of thing that people can be irrational about, you know. It can really push people's buttons. So it was extraordinary.
Yeah. Mm. You and I have one thing in common, and that is a certain amount of amplitude. And I copped it, you know, as a little fat boy in the playground, the cruelest place on earth. I've never understood this because, of course, when one thinks of heavenly bodies, you know, all those planets and suns up there, they're round, balloons, immensely likable things are round. Why do people pick on us?
Yeah, good question. Because it goes through phases, doesn't it? It's been a long time since curvaceousness has really been.
Do you think we're on the way back?
I think so. I think things are changing enormously. It's really different now. And I think African Americans have played a really big part in that, actually, because they're, you know, they seem to culturally be much more, you know, they like the big booty, and those girls are not shy about it. No, you know, they won't take any nonsense about it.
One does detect a greater tolerance. But, you know, you and I have lived through some extraordinary changes, going back to sexuality.
Yeah.
I think, although I'm much older than you, I suspect that you do remember number 96, yes?
I do, yeah.
Well, do you remember the character of Joe Hashem? It was the first time that a gay character had been sensitively written in a soap. And you could feel Australia's attitudes changing. Was it social engineering? I don't know. There was a bit of that going on in soaps. But you could feel the country having second thoughts.
Well, I think that's like now you look at shows like Glee, you know. I mean, that's absolutely changing the world and the way we think and in terms of diversity and inclusiveness. And I think, you know, the world has kind of always divided, which is to do with fundamentalisms, you know, people who can cope with complexity and those who can't. And that's more of a psychological disposition, I think, than anything. Because, I mean, that's why with religious people, there are some, you know, many religious people who are extremely subtle, complex, soulful thinkers, you know. So, you know, I think the world maybe is where, I don't know if it's to do with, I think maybe it does have something to do with the new technologies where we're just getting so much new information all the time that maybe we will just grow a brain that's able to deal with diversity much more, you know, and be less threatened by it. But one of the really interesting things this professor at this conference said was, because someone said, oh, you know, conflict, you know, coming from difference. And he said, conflict doesn't come from difference, it comes from inequality. So, you know, maybe if we get more accurate about understanding where the conflicts do come from.
Look, there's some truth in that. There's some truth in it. But going back to the playground, any form of difference at East Kew State was leapt upon. I remember chanting at poor little refugee kids who just come from Europe, having survived God knows what, go back to your own country, you refo. But I hope that's not the case in the playgrounds of the 21st century. But hearing all the stuff about bullying and all that stuff on Facebook, so I suspect it's still pretty bad out there for kids.
Well, maybe this is a time when it's just all sort of coming out, as it were. You know, there've been so much stuff has been sort of suppressed and repressed, and maybe we're living through a time when all of the ugliness of human nature has to come out.
Yeah.
You know, maybe that's the purpose Jerry Springer serves, to just show the mad and the crazy and the bad side of us or something.
Say the name in Polish again for me, please. I'm talking to
Magdalena Maria Teresa Szubańska.
Wow. Just gorgeous.
Oh,
okay,
thanks.
I think people would probably like me to ask you a bit about being funny. When did you realise you were? Because you are very.
Thank you.
You're too funny. You're dangerously funny.
Oh, I do love having fun and being funny. I'm glad you think I'm funny. I'm glad people think I'm funny because that means I get to do it. But I remember really vividly, my mother is hilarious and very dry, and she's nearly 89, but she's still to this, you know, she doesn't have like old lady humour. It's like naughty, cheeky, you know, a bit meaner than me, but very funny. And I remember when I must have been about five or six, Yeah, I must have been about six because I came home from school and I can't remember exactly what it was I said, but I made my mother laugh.
Yeah.
And that was just like, yes, I've arrived. You know,
yeah, you're like St. Joan hearing her voices. Something marvellous had happened.
Yeah, yeah. And then, but then it was, I never thought I would be a comedian ever. I wanted to be a doctor. I was obsessed with medicine from the age of three. I, you know, by the time I was nine, I knew the name of every body in the bone in the human body. I knew how to dissect a person from reading my father's old anatomy books, you know. So it didn't, it really was just when I was at uni. And it for a long time, it felt like kind of I did comedy because I wasn't really good at other things, or I was okay at other things, but I you know, can lose my confidence terribly. And comedy seemed like a way of just subverting it so that I wouldn't get too, you know, perfectionist or something. But then gradually, as time went by, I just started to really love it, you know. But
if you cultivate a sense of your own ridiculousness, if you keep reminding yourself of your frailties, it's a good way of coping with them.
Oh, it's the most gorgeous feeling. And when you share that with other people, like, and absolutely, you're right, the sense of your own ridiculousness, I think really is up there as one of the best feelings ever, you know, along with, you know, laughing in church and all those kind of things. But it's really, you know, those moments when you catch yourself and then you can just pull back from it and go, oh, for God's sake. You know,
Coming back to the appalling problems with your, you know, that your parents endured reminds me of my absolute central belief about humour, laughter, jokes, whatever, and that is that we are alone in the universe, as far as we know, of being with the knowledge of our mortality. We know about death. And what evolution has given us to help us cope with this dread awareness is laughter. To me, laughter mm-hmm. is the other side of that same coin.
Totally. It is so funny you're saying this because it so is exactly something I'm writing about at the moment, and you will see eventually. But
this is the autobiography.
Yes, amongst other things, yeah. But for me, it is so physical that... you know, I'm no stranger to the dark moods. You know, clearly you can tell I'm a, you know, serious little insect. But it's so physical and it's so effervescent. That feeling of joy and naughtiness and the ridiculousness of things, and to me, it absolutely always, like you said, well, it feels like the life force asserting itself. And when I look at my father, who saw some, you know, I'm not going to tell you some of the things he saw, but I mean, unimaginable horror, just inconceivable, but still, you know, had a sense of optimism and humour. And the same with my Irish grandfather, who similarly, you know, and both funny men, you know.
It's interesting, isn't it, that people who have had the worst, the rough end of the pineapple historically, the Irish are certainly a case, but the Jews overwhelmingly always have a genius for comedy. The disproportionate number of Jews in comedy is like the disproportionate numbers of Jews in music.
Yeah. Oh, Jewish humour is just brilliant. You know, it's my, like Seinfeld, Larry David. Oh, my God, it's so great. Not a lot of Polish humour, though. That's not, or maybe it's a language thing, but Polish humour is really, I mean, their humour is really complex because it grew under the oppression of, you know, the Tsarist regime or, you know, the Nazis and then the communists. They've had to go underground with it, to the point that to a foreigner you can barely detect it, but they know exactly, and it's all nearly always directed at the Russians, the Polish humour.
But, you see, we're talking about a Polish film. I remember all the Polish films during the Cold War and the Czech films, you know.
Yeah.
And they were all dazzlingly clever. They were in code. They were thumbing their nose courageously, usually at the Soviet or their own regimes. But that was one of the great gifts of Poland, was the nudge-nudge, wink-wink response to tyranny.
Well, you know, my cousin is an actress, a famous actress in Poland. Have I told you that?
No.
Whose name is Magda, believe it or not. And she's older than me, but she she was in a Polish epic called Pan Wojciechowski, which was a, you know, like their sort of Ben-Hur. But she did a lot of romantic comedies, and her husband was like the Laurence Olivier of Poland, like seriously, you know, revered. But she was part of there's a Polish cabaret called Dudek, and it was all in that, you know, woven in through it. But even the way they do Shakespeare, it was so political for them. And I remember going to see Shakespeare in Warsaw in Polish, and I don't speak a word of Polish, but they'd be getting things and laughing at things, and, you know, the censors would be there, but they couldn't, it was so elusive, they couldn't quite ever get it, and they couldn't really nail them on it, but the Poles would be pissing themselves, and, you know.
The voice of comedian, actor, and so much more, Magda Szubanski, talking to me earlier this year. And you're listening to LNL on RN Summer. You are intensely political, but you don't do a lot of overtly political humour.
No, I know. I am intensely, but I am actually, yeah. Which I, yeah, but no, I haven't really.
It's not a criticism. Really. I'm just curious.
No, it's something I've kind of noticed about myself too. I haven't really. I don't know. Maybe it's something I'll engage in more as I'm getting older or something. I wonder about that, if that might be something of my father's experience that's just made me want to steer away from it or something.
On the one hand, you've already pointed out that you are sensitive, you are shy, and perhaps you finally don't want that sort of confrontation.
Oh, yeah, I hate confrontation. I hate conflict. Yeah. I just really don't like it.
So do I. I never have rows on the program. I'm always terribly nice to people I detest.
I think there might be an element of being in the closet about that before too, of just feeling somehow kind of weakened or vulnerable or something. And I think since I've come out, I feel so much stronger. And, you know, that very overused phrase, empowered.
Yeah.
It's kind of something that's very easy to go, cliche, about until you can feel it within you. And it's an extraordinary feeling. And I had no idea it was going to feel like this. And for a while, I was frightened that for me it wouldn't. But I think that there was something that it just was like a, you know, it was like having a kryptonite inside me or something, I think. And so I think that did make me sort of stay away from any kind of public arena, really, in a sense. And now I kind of feel like I have nothing to hide, I think. So maybe that'll change. It's interesting you say that, because it's something I've kind of been thinking about.
There was a sense of humour, I think, in the day you chose to come out, Valentine's Day.
That was Karen Phelps' suggestion, actually, which is a beauty, yeah.
it was the special day for my old friend Joan Lindsay. It was the day in which he met Daryl, married Daryl. It's the day, of course, for Picnic at Hanging Rock. It's a day with a lot of clout.
You know, I had been thinking for a while about it, and I had a bunch of friends, Alex Greenwich, who's the head of marriage equality, and Karen Phelps and Jackie Stricker, and we were kind of thinking about what's a good way to do it, and Karen said, why don't you come out on Valentine's Day? And it's something I do really like about the gay community, is that it's a very humorous kind of, you know, rainbow-coloured revolution. And I like the fact that we subvert in that way, you know. I think that's a really great tradition and a great way of, you know, it's like a form of non-violent protest, isn't it, really?
It is, and here's another group that need humour to survive and to cope.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah. I look at what's going on. I mean, there's not a hell of a lot of representation here, I have to say, which is kind of disturbing. There's not, you know, there've been not a lot of credible sort of gay romances really on primetime Australian television.
Well, there was one, and it was a film called Gallipoli, and I remember making this point to David Williamson that it was
gay
first, the first male love story. And both David and Peter admitted to me that the film was, in fact, a projection of their own intense relationship in collaborating.
Oh, wow. It's all subtext, though.
It's all subtext. It's not up front. Yeah.
Yeah, whereas, you know, in Britain and America, I'm using other English-speaking countries here, but, you know, the stuff that's happening, like on Glee and... Yeah. Oh, it's amazing. It's amazing.
But you've got enough power and enough influence, enough leverage in this country to drive it in that direction.
Well, maybe I am.
Is that what you're doing and you're not telling us?
Oh, I can't Heavens. Tell you. This is music to a Gerdo's ears. I know you will be the first to know, Philip. Yeah. You will be.
Well,
the
that's
first
not
to
true.
Know.
That's not true.
You might be.
You tantalising creature. No wonder I professed undying love in that restaurant 30 years ago.
Because I'm a tease.
You're self-taught, aren't you? You didn't go to sort of school and learn to be funny. You sort of developed your personas, you developed your approach to comedy yourself.
Yeah. I steered clear of any of the institutions because the only instinct I had was to know that mine was a slightly precarious and unusual kind of talent, I think, and a self-preservation instinct, you know, led me to understand that had I gone to NIDA and been pulled apart and picked to pieces, I would never have been able to put myself back together again. I did a very brief, intermittent, you know, on and off year at Melbourne Uni, but really no
what
training
What were you
at
studying,
all.
Medicine?
No, I ended up doing philosophy and art history. But I was also working in a women's refuge, and it was entirely possible I could have gone down that path into sort of social welfare. But I ended up auditioning for a law review and got in, and it just kind of went from there, really.
The law review, heavens above.
The law review.
I remember Barry Humphrey saying if you wanted to see the next generation of great humorists in Australia, you went to the law review at Melbourne Uni.
Yeah, it's been a breeding ground for so many, you know, all the working dog guys and just so many people. It's some people sometimes like to suggest it's a mafia, and it's if only it was that easy. But certainly it has been a lot of out of the architecture review as well.
Yes, in Sydney and Melbourne. Architects also give up architecture and become Graham Bonds, for example.
Yeah, well, the architects, their stuff is always more wacky. Their stuff is always much more surreal and really arty and inventive. Often they're
more visual, perhaps.
Yes, indeed.
Being architects,
yes, and written with very small, very neat handwriting.
I think the great thing about that is many of them never go on to build horrible buildings. It's much the Auntie Jack show to me is a monument.
Yes, comedy's gain is probably architecture's gain too, really, isn't it? In that case.
There are there not quite amazingly interesting, idiosyncratic Australian approaches to humour?
You
say that with doubt.
No. I absolutely think there is. I mean, there's kind of like a, you know, people often do go off to the US and there's almost like a farming kind of thing, you know, where so many young talents end up going over to the US, which we've got to be careful of. You know, we'll lose our sort of, you know, we'll end up with a brain drain. But there is a sort of a different kind of, there's a love of the underdog, I think, that we have that maybe the Americans don't get. They've caught up in the sarcasm stakes, though. I mean, you know, and that's a lot to do with the Jewish humour. Like their sense of irony and sarcasm is, it's just so fantastic.
But sometimes I find it too much to handle. I find Larry David stuff so excruciating.
I go and put my head
under a cushion.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Arrested Development.
Wonderful. How'd I be its name? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, hilarious.
I thought the Gary Shandling show was one of the great triumphs of American comedy.
Yeah, there's a lot. I love Friends too. I thought that was a great show. But here it's really difficult because we don't We're not good with lowbrow comedy in this country. We have no respect for it. There's no critical tradition that really knows how to deal with it.
I'm sorry. Explain what you're saying to me. I don't get it.
Well, in that sort of lowbrow kind of, you know how the Americans will churn out those films like a Dumb and Dumber and things like that?
Oh, right.
There's nothing here. We're all kind of geared
towards...
We did
Barry McKenzie in 1970 and Elvin and that stuff.
I know, but not much since in that, and it's hard to, because there's also, I think, critics don't really have the same tolerance for Australian lowbrow humour as they do for American.
Do you remember when The Castle was attacked by quite a lot of critics who should have known better? There's often the argument that it's condescending or patronising when it's usually celebratory.
Yeah, well, so is Kath and Kim.
Of course it
is. But, I mean, Kath and Kim was neither celebratory nor condemnatory. It was a product of the suburbs, which is Australia is an absolutely suburban nation. It doesn't matter if you're living in the inner suburbs. You're either fleeing from or to the suburbs. You're defined by the suburbs. It doesn't matter if you live within 7 km of the CBD. I mean, I grew up in Croydon, one of the outer suburbs of Melbourne. You know, it's not like that's not in me.
Yeah.
And I think we all have a sort of a very problematic and complex relationship to the suburbs, and the interesting thing would be the number of people who they'd come up to me and go, "Oh, we love it. It's exactly like us." And they had no shame or problem with it. It was kind of
a thrill of recognition. My life totally is being represented on this screen. Yeah.
Finally, you know, and you have to know it to represent it. So it's clearly within us.
Listen, a lot of people listening to you on their little wireless program will be astonished to be confronted by a woman of extraordinary intelligence. In my experience, the best comics are so bloody smart. I mean, Sean McAuliffe, Steve Martin, Barry Humphries, John Clark, Gina, and your team, you're all bloody smart. To be funny, you've got to be a great analyst. You've got to see with X-ray vision.
Yeah, I think that is true, that all the people I know who do it at a high level are smart, and that it comes from, I mean, for me, you know, in defence of like a liberal arts education, I did philosophy at uni, which seemingly would be not vocational at all. What it is perfect training for is to become a comedian, because it is about, there's a great, I think it was Umberto Eco said, you know, it's making the familiar unfamiliar, so that you, a thing that you take for granted and see all the time, that you suddenly subvert it and go, oh, wow, it could be like this. So, I think, you know, they say comedy is the angry art as well, and I don't know if I've been especially angry in anything I've done, but yeah, I suppose I'm agreeing with you to some extent.
I want to add to all the pile of prizes that breaking your mantelpiece under their bulk and weight by giving you a koala stamp, which is the highest award this program can endow. 10 out of 10 and a koala stamp.
Oh, that's going to take the pride of place, let me tell you. That I set great store by that. Thank
and
you.
30 years later, I re-profess my love to you, Magda. You're just terrific.
Oh, right back at you. Thank you.
And Magda's latest film, Goddess, is out now on DVD. Our chat is one of a number of the best interviews from Late Night Live, now available on a stick, a USB stick, which you can get from an ABC shop. We'll be back with more of our best from this year next week on RN Summer. See you then.